It's 2 o'clock in Montreal. Coming up is Mosaic, and you're listening to the CKT Radio at 90.3 FM. I'm Sarah Hassanin. Here's the news from Alice Wu.
My name is Alice Wu, and here are some of the recent headlines. On Sunday afternoon, hundreds of people met at Place Émile de Gamelin in Ville-Marie for the March for Status for All. This event was organized by the community group Solidarity Across Borders. They want the federal government to grant permanent residency status to all people living on Canadian soil, so these people can access health care and other social services. And Grenadian Montrealers are demanding the city for answers after a suspected case of racial profiling. Last month, 15 police officers appeared at a barbecue outside Green's restaurant in Lachine. The officers included members of the Eclipse Squad, who specialize in organized crime. This was in response to a noise complaint at 8:30 p.m. on Jean-Baptiste Day, Quebec's national holiday. And last week, the Quebec government agreed to give the Long Point First Nation in Winneway its own regional police force. The new unit will be made of Indigenous patrol officers and replace the provincial force. This comes after more than 15 years of negotiations and concerns about slow response times from provincial officers. And as of Thursday, doctors in Quebec can prescribe the abortion pill as long as they feel qualified to do so. In the past, doctors were required to complete an in-person training program to perform medical and surgical abortions. This policy change comes after at least 300 Quebec doctors signed an open letter demanding the removal of restrictions surrounding abortion pill access. And the Montreal Children's Hospital's emergency room is overwhelmed. On Sunday, the hospital sent a news release asking parents of children seeking non-urgent care to avoid going to the ER. My name is Alice Wu, and here are some of the recent headlines. On Saturday, the World Health Organization declared the current monkeypox outbreak to be a global health emergency. This is the organization's highest alert level, aimed at encouraging countries to invest more in treatments and vaccines. There are around 700 cases in Canada, with nearly half in Quebec. And the Quebec government has approved the Moderna vaccine, called Spikevax, for children between 6 months and 5 years old. Parents can get appointments through the province's Clic Santé online health portal. Quebec recommends two doses and waiting at least 8 weeks between doses. Some immunocompromised children may get a third dose. And this week, Pope Francis is visiting Canada. He's in Quebec City from July 27th to July 29th. The Roman Catholic Church says the goal of the visit is to promote healing among the First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities, whose children endured abuse in residential schools run by the church. And Montréal and Place des Arts just became Montreal's 20th and 21st universally accessible metro stations. This means that they now have elevators and wheelchair-accessible entrances. And now for some news you can use. Jeunesse Lambda is organizing a picnic for trans and non-binary youth between the ages of 14 and 30. The event is free and takes place this Saturday, July 23rd at 1:30 p.m. in Parc La Fontaine. Food will be provided, but you can also bring your own. To learn more, visit the Jeunesse Lambda Facebook page. And last Friday marked the return of the NDG Borough's weekly neighborhood farmers market. Every Friday from 1 to 6 p.m., you can buy fresh local produce at the corner of Monkland and Old Orchard, near the Monkland Tavern. And if you live in another borough, look up your local farmers market. There are at least 14 in Montreal this summer. Search for MTL Blog Farmers Markets. And the Grand Poutine Fest kicked off in Montreal last week. It's running in the Old Port from now until July 31st and features plenty of creative flavor combinations. This year, all poutines are sold in reusable dishes, and part of each sale goes to the pediatrics nonprofit Opération Enfant Soleil. For more information, search for Le Grand Poutine Fest on Facebook. And now for some news you can use. The nonprofit The Yellow Door is looking for volunteers for their Generations program. It fights isolation among older populations and creates intergenerational relationships. Each volunteer is paired with a senior with common interests and is expected to share 1 to 2 hours of their week. For more information, visit yellowdoor.org and click on the Programs tab. And the Open Door Shelter is seeking donations of spare smartphones, as well as several clothing items. To see what items are needed, visit the shelter's new Instagram page, which is Open Door Porte Ouverte. You can also follow the page. And the Fantasia International Film Festival is ongoing in Montreal. It's the largest genre film festival in North America and focuses on films produced outside of Hollywood, including in other continents. The festival takes place in various buildings on the Concordia University campus until August 3rd. For more information, visit fantasiafestival.com. And the Museum of Jewish Montreal is showcasing a classic Jewish food in an event called A Tale of Two Bagels. It discusses how New York and Montreal bagels relate to Jewish cultural identity, and it includes food samples. The event is August 4th at 6 p.m. at the museum's location on Saint-Laurent. Tickets are $10. To reserve yours, visit museemontrealjuif.ca.
Je m'appelle Alice Wu et voici quelques des gros titres récents. Le dimanche après-midi, des centaines de personnes se sont rassemblées à Place Émile de Gamelin dans Ville-Marie pour la marche pour un statut pour tout. L'organisateur était Solidarité sans frontières, un groupe demandant que le gouvernement fédéral accorde un statut de résidence permanente à toute personne vivant en sol canadien. Ainsi, ces personnes pourraient accéder aux soins de santé et d'autres services sociaux. Et la communauté grenadienne de Montréal exige des réponses de la ville après un cas suspect de profilage racial. Le mois dernier, 15 policiers sont apparus à un barbecue devant Green's Restaurant à la Chine. Quelques des agents font partie de la section Eclipse, qui se spécialise en crimes organisés. Il répondait à une plainte de bruit à 20h30 le jour de la fête nationale. Et la semaine dernière, le gouvernement de Québec a décidé d'accorder à la Première Nation de Long Point à Winneway sa propre force de police. L'unité sera composée d'agents autochtones et prendra la place de la force provinciale. Cette décision survient après plus de 15 ans de négociations et de préoccupations concernant des longs délais de réponse de la part des agents provinciaux. Et dès jeudi dernier, les médecins québécois peuvent prescrire la pilule abortive pourvu qu'ils se sentent qualifiés. Dans le passé, les médecins devaient suivre un programme de formation en personne pour faire des avortements médicaux ou chirurgicaux. Ce changement de politique est en réponse à une lettre ouverte signée par au moins 300 médecins dans la province. Il exigeait l'enlèvement des restrictions concernant l'accès à la pilule abortive. Et la salle des urgences de l'hôpital de Montréal pour enfants est débordée. Le dimanche, l'hôpital a envoyé un communiqué de presse demandant aux parents des enfants qui ne sont pas dans un état urgent d'éviter de visiter les urgences.
Je m'appelle Alice Wu et voici quelques des gros titres récents. Le samedi, l'Organisation mondiale de la santé a déclaré l'épidémie de la variole simienne une urgence de santé publique de portée internationale. Celle-ci est le plus haut niveau d'alerte possible et censé encourager les nations à investir plus en traitements et vaccins. Il y a environ 700 cas de variole simienne au Canada, et presque un demi sont au Québec. Et le gouvernement du Québec a autorisé le vaccin de Moderna, appelé Spikevax, pour les enfants de 6 mois à 5 ans. Les parents peuvent maintenant programmer un rendez-vous en utilisant le portail de santé numérique Clic Santé. Le gouvernement recommande que les enfants reçoivent 2 doses et attendent au moins 8 semaines entre eux. Certains enfants immunodéprimés peuvent recevoir une 3e dose. Et cette semaine, le pape François visite le Canada et il visite la ville de Québec en particulier du 27 au 29 juillet. Selon l'Église catholique, le but de la visite est de promouvoir la guérison parmi les communautés Premières Nations, Métis et Inuits, dont les enfants ont été des objets d'abus dans les pensionnats gérés par l'Église. Et Montréal et Place des Arts sont devenus la 20e et 21e gare de métro accessibles dans la ville. Cela signifie qu'elles ont maintenant des entrées qui permettent l'accès chaises roulantes ainsi que des ascenseurs. Maintenant, voici des nouvelles directement pertinentes à votre vie. Jeunesse Lambda organise un pique-nique pour les jeunes trans et non-binaires de 14 à 30 ans. Cet événement gratuit aura lieu ce samedi 23 juillet à 13h30 au Parc La Fontaine. La nourriture sera offerte, mais vous pouvez aussi apporter votre propre repas. Pour en savoir plus, visitez la page Facebook Jeunesse Lambda. Et vendredi dernier a marqué le retour du marché fermier du quartier Notre-Dame-de-Grâce. Chaque vendredi de 13 à 18 heures, vous pouvez acheter des produits frais et locaux à l'angle des avenues Monkland et Old Orchard, près du taverne Monkland. Si vous n'êtes pas un résident de NDG, il y a au moins 14 autres marchés de fermiers de quartier à Montréal cet été. Recherchez MTL Blog Farmers Markets pour plus d'informations. Et le Grand Poutine Fest a démarré à Montréal la semaine dernière. Il se déroule au Vieux-Port jusqu'au 31 juillet et offre plusieurs combinaisons de saveurs créatives. Cette année, toutes les poutines sont servies dans des plats réutilisables et une partie des bénéfices sera donnée à l'opération Enfant Soleil, une organisation sans but lucratif. Pour en savoir plus, recherchez le Grand Poutine Fest sur Facebook. Maintenant, voici quelques nouvelles directement pertinentes à votre vie. L'organisme sans but lucratif, La Porte Jaune, cherche des bénévoles pour son programme Génération. Il vise à réduire l'isolation parmi les personnes âgées et d'établir des relations intergénérationnelles. Chaque bénévole est jumelé avec une aînée avec des intérêts communs et est tenu de donner entre 1 et 2 heures de son temps par semaine. Pour en apprendre plus, visitez fr.yellowdoor.org et cliquez sur l'onglet appelé « Programme ». Et La Porte Ouverte, un centre pour les personnes en situation d'itinérance, cherche des dons de smartphones et de plusieurs pièces de vêtements. Pour plus d'informations, incluant les articles désirés, visitez la nouvelle page d'Instagram du centre Open Door Porte Ouverte. Vous pouvez aussi suivre le profil. Et le Musée du Montréal juif va mettre en valeur un aliment typiquement juif, le bagel, avec un événement nommé A Tale of Two Bagels. Des historiens y discuteront comment les bagels de Montréal et de New York sont liés à l'identité culturelle juive et on pourra y profiter des échantillons. L'événement aura lieu le 4 août à 18h au bâtiment du musée, situé sur le boulevard Saint-Laurent. Les billets coûtent 10$. Pour en réserver un, visitez le site web museemontrealjuif.ca. Et le Festival international de films Fantasia est en cours à Montréal. C'est le plus grand festival de films de genre en Amérique du Nord et se concentre sur les œuvres produites en dehors de Hollywood, incluant celles provenant d'autres continents. Le festival a lieu dans différents bâtiments sur le campus de l'Université Concordia jusqu'au 3 août. Pour en savoir plus, visitez fantasiafestival.com.
And that was the news from Alice Wu. You're listening to Mosaic from the CKUT Radio at 90.3 FM Montreal. I'm Sarah Hassanin. Sri Lanka is hit by a huge economic crisis. The crisis is said to have begun due to multiple compounding factors like tax cuts, money creation, a nationwide policy to shift to biological farming, the 2019 Sri Lanka Easter bombings, let alone the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Pranjal Malik has Ms. Julia Marshall, spokesperson for the UN World Food Programme in Canada.
Sri Lanka is going through an economic crisis where food inflation has reached a record high of 80% in June, impacting more than 6 million people, which is nearly 30% of the population. Julia, can you please elaborate more on the intensity of the situation?
Well, it's very worrying right now. We really need, as a community, as the international community, to act and to act quickly. As you said, that's 30% of the population of struggling to feed themselves. And what that really means is that women-headed households struggle the most. Women often eat last and least, so they go hungry. The safety nets, the government safety nets, school feeding, they reach about 1 in 4 children across the country, and they've been disrupted or put on hold. The nutritional programs for women and children, for young children and breastfeeding mothers and pregnant mothers, have been put on hold. So this is where we need to step up with emergency food cash and vouchers, but also make sure that the children and the women get the nutritional nutrition that they need.
Yes, exactly. Just going off of that, 2 in 5 households, those which are headed by women, are not eating enough, and the crisis leading to disruption in national school meal programs. So schools have been shut down, exams have been canceled because of printing paper shortage, and the most vulnerable of population is being impacted. How do you think that's adding on to just the most vulnerable being impacted the most, and just the sheer intensity of the crisis?
Well, yeah, I mean, about 11 years ago, I was in Sri Lanka, and I saw some of these programs myself. I went to see the school feeding programs and the nutritional programs. These are programs that are run by the government, but supported by WFP. So we'll supply fortified food, fortified nutritious products for women and children, working alongside our partners so that the women and children also have receive information on how to feed their children and look after themselves, antenatal care, etc. But what we saw was that these programs are vital, especially the ones I saw in the rural poor, but it's also hitting, this crisis is hitting the urban population as well. So a school meal, for instance, if you've got 2 or 3 children going to school, these school meals can be their only nutritious meal of the day. It also gets and encourages families to continue to send their children to school where they can get the food that they need. So it's vital that that WFP picks up this and helps to support the government and continue to feed children. And of course, as well, you have a small window of opportunity to make sure that women and small children get the nutrition that they need. And if they don't, they can have consequences throughout their life. And in Sri Lanka, what I saw even then was not so much a lack of food, but a lack of nutrition. So that's where our programs are going to focus, as well as emergency assistance. And that can come in the shape of fortified rice, wheat, oil, lentils, but also cash. So if there is, in fact, food in the markets, then WFP can give women, the most vulnerable women, cash vouchers so they can go and purchase this nutritious food themselves. And that helps inject that cash into the local community as well. So that's where we need to focus, and we need to do it quickly.
Yes, definitely. You guys are doing great work. My next question was just that, what is WFP's plan on how is the aid being provided, to get more specific?
Well, we're going to reach, by the end of the year, we're looking to reach around 3.4 million people. So we're going to do that threefold. So first of all, addressing and supporting the school meals program. So around 1 million children will reach there. Again, fortified food is the focus. And about 1 million pregnant and breastfeeding women and their young children. And about 1.4 million with the emergency assistance to the most vulnerable people. Again, that's very often the elderly, women, children, small children, people with disabilities. So we make sure that we're reaching that those people by the end of the year. So we put out an appeal, I think it was about a month or so ago, and we need to raise $63 million. That will cover our costs for those programs I just outlined till the end of the year. And at the moment, that's not funded. We're only about a third of the way through. So we've raised around $20.1 million. So that means that we can only reach a third of our target. You know, this is, and we're being, this, as you said, there's over 6 million people in need of food assistance right now, or of humanitarian assistance. So we need to, even just if we're targeting just the most vulnerable, we can't do that with the lack of funding at the moment.
Oh, that is really terrifying and heartbreaking. Lastly, I just want to ask, how can we as people help in this situation? I know there's an app, Share the Meal app as well, if you want to talk about that and just any link or anything as such.
Yeah, that's great. So, I mean, one of the things that's really important is that people are talking about it. So this is really helpful that you're talking about it on your show today. And it's good for the students to, you know, to share this information over their social media channels, make sure people are aware and that something can be done. The numbers are huge, 6 million people going hungry. You know, people think they can't make a difference, but they can. So they can go to WFP.org and they can learn more about the work that we do globally. The World Food Programme reached around 114 million people every year in 123 different countries. We have an app called Share the Meal, which you just touched on. So you can download this WFP app. It's won lots of awards. We've fed millions of people through this app. And it allows you to just choose which program you want to send your funds to. So Sri Lanka is in there. So are other countries in need, like Yemen, like Afghanistan, like Lebanon. So you can choose which country you want to support. And it costs around $1.10 Canadian to support one meal. So you can choose to support 50 meals, which is about $55, and you can choose where it goes to. And once you've made your donation on the app, you can then share that information on your social media. So you can tell everybody on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram that you've just done this, and invite your friends and your network to do the same.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for that. That is, it really brings into perspective how it's such a little difference for anyone who's here, but how much like that one meal would mean for someone who's going through that crisis. So
it's very true. I mean, I think back to the women and the children that I met when I was in Sri Lanka, and, you know, the meals that they received for their children were, you know, made a huge difference to them every single day. It made a difference to a lot of the girls that maybe wouldn't have been in school. So, you know, when you think about, okay, $1.10, what that can buy you here, it can make a real difference to somebody's life. And then you times that by 10 or 15 or 30, whatever you can do, and you're making a difference to, you know, to a whole classroom of girls, or to, you know, a room full of women holding their small babies. And right now they really need this help because of this crisis, because of the impact of COVID, because of the remittances that have dropped to the country. That's what this economic crisis is about. And then it's compounded by the growing costs of food and fuel. They just don't have the foreign currency to purchase those goods right now and bring them into the country. So it's having the biggest effect on the most vulnerable as those programs are being cut. So we really need to do something quickly.
Yes, we do. And thank you so much for your time. And thank you so much for bringing more attention to this issue and the work that you're doing. It's really great. And yeah, I'll stop recording.
You're listening to Mosaic from the CKT Radio at 90.3 FM, and I'm Sarah Hassanin. Stay tuned.
في حد ساعات بيكون جنبك وما بتشوفوش، ما تحسش ابدا بوجوده مع انه قريب، وفي حد يفارق ويسيبنا انما بيعيش جوه قلوبنا. بتغيب الشمس إنما اسمه عمره ما بيغيب. في فرق ما بين جسم بيمشي وروح ما بتمشيش، واللي انت أكيد سايبه ما بين تدلين نسيان. فرحت كتير وأوجه درنا ومعك هنكمل مشوار، أصلي ما فيش في الدنيا دي أغلى من روح إنسان. وعشان أجيال بعدنا جايين يفضلوا فاكرين يفضلوا عارفين، وعشانك حتة منا وعشان تفكر ما بينا يفضل اسمك معنا سنين وسنين. وعشان أجيال بعدنا جايين وعشان مش عايز نخسر ناس وجعنا. ومن غير ما نقول بنعيش الدنيا بإحساسك بنشوف بعينيك، وعشان من قلبنا بنحبك هنوصل حني بقلبك للناس اللي ما نسيوش حبك وتعلقوا بيك. وعشان أجيال
is at its best when it speaks truth to power. Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Aqla was shot by Israeli snipers on May 11 while covering the atrocities at the Jenin camp in Palestine. But her legacy will still hold up, and the memory of her bravery will never fade, and no one can take that from us. Rima Raji talks to Haytham Qureshi, one of Shireen Abu Aqla's neighbors from Palestine. Qureshi lives in Maryland in the U.S. Today, he takes us on a reminiscent journey as he recollects his memories with Aqla back in their homeland, occupied Palestine. Qureshi is also the coordinator of the Museum for the Palestinian People.
Okay, so before we get started with the questions, can you just briefly introduce yourself, where you're from, where you grew up, where you work, volunteer, etc.?
Okay, sweet. So my name is Haytham Qureshi. I am a Palestinian living here in Maryland in the United States. Originally, my family is from the city of Tul Kerem in Palestine, which is half of it's in the West Bank, half of it's in the occupied territories now under Israel. So it's kind of split between East and West. So I was born in the state of Maryland. And then when I was 6 years old in 2002, I moved to the West Bank. I moved to Palestine during the Second Intifada, so which was a really, really difficult period, especially for us as Palestinians in terms of freedom of movement, rights, access, a lot of horrible, horrible events, and a lot of difficulties growing up. And then I came back to Maryland around 2006. So a year after the Intifada was technically over, which was 2005. And so, you know, growing up, I've always had a fascination with history and geography. And I've always talked about Palestine in one way or another, whether it was related to our realities, politics, but also even cool stuff as well. Things about cities, culture. And I wanted to dive more deep into that. So today I actually work as a museum coordinator on Saturdays at the Museum of the Palestinian People located in Washington, D.C. I started out giving tours there as a docent. And, you know, I found it really fun. It gave me a lot of practice when it came to public speaking, but also speaking on very difficult topics, especially topics that, you know, in Western media don't get covered or don't get covered very well. And being a Palestinian, being able to talk about my story and my experiences, you know, we, not as a news journalist or anchor, but as a storyteller and someone who has lived experience, and always likes to learn. So, you know, working there has driven me to learn more about Palestine, not just our struggle, but also resilience, culture, history, the many diverse communities that have come and gone over the centuries and millennia, and a lot more of that. So, you know, it's been a really good place. The museum is like the Palestinian Cultural Embassy in Washington, D.C., which is convenient because of Washington, D.C.'s status in the world stage. And yeah, that's a lot about me.
How old were you when you first heard about Shein Abouakle or saw her on the news?
So when I first saw her on the news, I was living in Palestine. I was living in the city of Ramallah. And so I believe I was 8 or 9 years old when I heard about her. So we'll say like 2003 or 2004.
And what was the general perception or opinion of her?
So interestingly enough, and this kind of ties into the question right before this one. So in Ramallah, I've lived in a few places, a few different neighborhoods, and there was one neighborhood called Al-Masyun. And I think it was still developing at the time as a neighborhood. And so when we were moving to our apartment building, one of the things the people showing us the apartment were saying as like a marker or something significant was that the Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abouakle lives in this building. She lives on the upper floors of the building. And I lived on the third floor out of, I think there was 9 floors total in this building. And, you know, I had her name in the back of my head. And, you know, as children over there, it's like we watched either cartoons or the news, which a lot of times was Al Jazeera because they covered a lot. And so I had exposure to seeing Shirin Abouakle's, you know, news reports and everything she had to say. And whenever she would sign off saying Shirin Abouakle, Al Jazeera, and whatever location, I was like, oh my gosh, that's the famous lady that lives in my building. Because at the time I never met her, but I knew who she was. And like a lot of people did know who she was because of her impact and being on such a huge channel like Al Jazeera.
Wow. Okay. So when the news about the killing of Abouakle was out, how did this affect you personally?
So when I first heard about it, it was around midnight here in the US. And at first I saw one post with her face on it and I said, wait, she looks familiar. Is that Shirin? But I didn't read the captions or anything. I just saw the picture and I thought, I didn't think too much of it. I just kept scrolling. And then as I refreshed my page, I started seeing more pictures of Shirin. And I said, wait, why am I seeing her so much? And I found out that she was killed. I believe it was by a sniper, like an Israeli sniper in one of Jenin's refugee camps. And I was totally in shock because although I didn't know her personally, she was in our living rooms. She was on our TV screens. Al Jazeera was usually on, especially during this time in the Intifada, you had to keep up with the news wherever it was. And the person that was reporting a lot on Palestinians and their struggle and different events on the ground was her. She was going to entire war zones or checkpoints or occupied zones, areas that a lot of us probably wouldn't want to be at, or places that were huge with tension, especially with the Israeli military. So, you know, her voice was powerful. A lot of us knew her name in different cities across Palestine.
Yeah, so having Palestinian family, peers, and working at the Museum of the Palestinian People, being surrounded by Palestinians, how did this seem to affect the general Palestinian community around you, as well as how did it affect, if it did, the operations of the museum?
Sure. It's interestingly enough, of course, many Palestinians were sharing on their stories and posting about Shirin Abouakle's death and her killing. But also, I also follow a few people that personally knew her or were family friends. So that added a little bit more of the hits, like the impact of it. And, you know, I worked at the museum one or two days after she was killed. And at the time, we were opening a new exhibit called Dreams Rising, which is art by children from Gaza who were born around the time of the Israeli blockade on Gaza. So these are kids that only know the blockade. So during this opening ceremony at the museum for this, you know, amazing event, very beautiful event and impactful and emotional, it was this added emotional layer that, you know, a significant Palestinian journalist who, you know, like I said, when we were kids, she was almost like a celebrity, you know, was killed for documenting and trying to tell the truth about the realities that we face. You know, she died doing her job and, you know, in a way she sacrificed herself for our cause. She was wearing a pressed vest and helmet. And it's very reminiscent of other times where, you know, nurses or other journalists would also be killed by Israeli military. Like in Gaza, in the Great March of Return, there was, I think her name was Razan Najjar. She was a nurse. And it was obvious with her white coat that she was a nurse, but she was gunned down. And I believe Israel still denies that she was killed or she is accused of associating with militants and whatnot. And so with the killing of Shireen, it's also frustrating for us to hear stories or words being twisted to make it seem like, oh, we don't have conclusive evidence, but we have people that were on the ground, civilians who recorded it as well. So it was just very tough. And the world, especially us, are calling for an independent investigation as well. So it just kind of shows the priorities, you know, we have in the world.
Yeah. Okay. So speaking of that, I was wondering, what implications do you think Shireen's death will have with regard to the supposed protection of journalists under international humanitarian law?
So I believe it does definitely raise a higher concern. And, you know, with Western media, you know, getting through Western media and their censors and the ways that is being reported on, it's nice to see that, you know, press releases and even American politicians talking about the killing of a journalist. But one thing with Shireen that I've noticed when it comes to at least American media is they emphasize a lot that she was a Palestinian American journalist. First, I didn't know she was a Palestinian American. I didn't know she had American citizenship. Apparently she did work here in the States. But would it have been less of a concern if it was just a Palestinian journalist without the dash, like without Palestinian American? If she was just listed as a Palestinian journalist, would it have received as much attention in the US, whether positive or negative, than if she was just a Palestinian journalist? So it just also raises the questions of priorities and double standards, I feel, because world organizations are one thing, but the players in the world organizations are a different factor. You know, like within the UN, there's five countries that really determine the fate of a lot of things, which is the US, UK, France, China, and Russia. So if one of those parties, you know, hops around or, you know, maneuvers or dodges, then even if the other 170 to 180, 190 UN members that aren't those five countries, you know, says something, then it's like their voice is minimized.
That was a part of Rima Raji's interview with Mr. Haitham Al-Qureshi, a Palestinian-American residing in Maryland. Mr. Qureshi is the coordinator for the Museum of the Palestinian People in Maryland. Muslims in Canada and all over the world had celebrated the Adha Eid, known as Sacrifice Day, on July 8th. Mosaic has promised to share their interview with Professor Awais Najjar, leader of the Canadian Islamic Center in Dollard-des-Ormeaux. Najjar holds a PhD in Islamic studies. He's an active member and has contributed to the well-being of the Muslim community in Quebec in many ways. Professor Najjar had a terrible flu, and so he had to put off the interview till he felt better. The interview was done by myself, Sarah Hassanin, in the Arabic language. Let's go. في بداية الحلقة المستمعين يحبوا يعرفوا من هو الدكتور عويس النجار.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. بداية أنا عويس النجار، دكتوراه من جامعة الأزهر الشريف، تخصص الأديان والمذاهب المعاصرة. أعمل إماما للمركز الإسلامي الكندي بمونتريال من عدة سنوات، ومن المؤسسين لمجلس أئمة كيبك وكذلك الأكاديمية الكندية للعلوم الإسلامية.
ما هي مظاهر احتفال الجالية الإسلامية بعيد الأضحى المبارك بمدينة مونتريال؟
مظاهر احتفال الجالية الإسلامية بمونتريال بعيد الأضحى المبارك كانت مظاهر طيبة وإقبال كثيف على المراكز الإسلامية، لأن هذا العام وافق العيد فيه الويك إند، وغالبا الاحتفالات يعني تكون أسرية على نطاق الأقارب والأصدقاء والمعارف. بعض المراكز الإسلامية الحقيقة أقامت حفلات للأسر والأطفال في أماكن عامة، وبها ألعاب وأشياء ترفيهية للأطفال ومأكولات خفيفة وهدايا للأطفال، وكذلك بعض الأسر بتذهب إلى المزارع في أول أيام العيد أو ثاني أيام العيد لإحياء شعيرة الأضحية مع الأطفال والأسرة والعائلة من باب إقامة النسك. كذلك في أيام العيد تتوجه بعض الأسر للمطاعم لإقامة العشاءات الجماعية الأسرية، يعني وهذا دليل على الفرحة والسعادة بالعيد. هكذا مظاهر العيد في الغرب هادئة وتقريبا يعني متشابهة في كل عيد إلى حد كبير.
سمعنا عن أداء الجالية الإسلامية شعائر صلاة العيد هذا العام بأحد الساحات العامة، هل يمكن حدوث مثل تلك الاحتفالات أو الشعائر بمقاطعة كيبك ولماذا؟
نعم، سمعنا عن أداء الجالية بأونتاريو ومقاطعات أخرى صلاة العيد عيد الأضحى المبارك بالساحات والخيام الخارجية التي تتسع تقريبا لعشرات الآلاف، ولا شك أن هذه الاجتماعات الكبيرة تعبر عن فرحة العيد بشكل أفضل، لأن العيد هو اجتماع للمسلمين وتعارف وتقارب ومحبة، وكلما كان العدد طبعا أكبر وفي خارج القاعات يعني الأماكن المفتوحة العامة كلما كان معبرا عن الفرحة والسعادة بشكل أفضل. وحقيقة أحد الزملاء أرسل لي صورا من أدمنتون لعشرات الآلاف خارج المركز في صوان كبير يعني معد خصيصا للصلاة، ولكن في أرض ملك للمركز. كذلك هنا في كيبك بعض المراكز تستأجر قاعات كبيرة ربما تتسع لأكثر من 5000 مصلي، لكن بالنسبة لصلاة العيد هنا في خارج المراكز في أماكن عامة هذا على حسب علمي ممنوع. ممنوع ليس للمسلمين فقط، إنما ممنوع لكل الأديان، فهو غير مسموح به، يعني غير مسموح بممارسة الشعائر والطقوس الدينية في الأماكن العامة المفتوحة حسب قانون المقاطعة، ونحن طبعا هنا ملتزمين بتطبيق القانون واحترامه.
في ظل قوانين حزب الكاك كوليسيون لافنير دي كيبك مثل قانون 21 اللي صدر سنة 2019 ومثل قانون 96 الذي صدر مؤخرا بخصوص اللغة الفرنسية، ما هي رؤيتكم وتوقعاتكم لمستقبل الجالية الإسلامية بهذه المقاطعة؟
في ظل قوانين 21 و96 ومستقبل الجالية بهذه المقاطعة، رأيي لا شك أن مثل هذه القوانين فيها تقييد لبعض الحريات، ونحن هنا في بلد الحريات والتعددية وحقوق الإنسان الدينية والثقافية والفكرية، والحقيقة أي قوانين لا تحقق العدالة الإنسانية يعترض عليها كذلك بالقانون، فنحن في بلد قانون ويحكم بالقانون. أما عن مستقبل الجالية فأراه للأفضل إن شاء الله، وإن كان البعض يعتريه بعض التخوفات فهي تخوفات مشروعة، لكن عموما الحديث حول المستقبل هو أمر نسبي متغير من وقت لآخر ومن سياسة لأخرى ومن مكان لآخر، وشكرا لكم.
في نهاية لقائنا أحب أشكر الأستاذ الدكتور عويس النجار، قيادي وعضو ناشط فعال بالنسبة للجالية الإسلامية في جميع أنحاء كيبك. دكتور النجار حاصل على درجة الدكتوراه في دراسة مقارنة الأديان والدراسات الإسلامية من جامعة الأزهر بمصر. That was my interview with Professor Awais Najjar, an Islamic leader in Quebec. And our interview was about how the Muslims celebrated the Adha Eid this year in Quebec, and how the province of Quebec, with its laws such as Law 21, Law 96, may have had an impact on the way Muslims are able to manifest their religious practices. And now we've come to the end of our show for this week, and it's time to roll into some fun Middle Eastern songs. At the end of our show, I'd like to thank Alice Wu, Pranjal Malik, Reem Araji, Spencer Gilly, and Jack Solar. I'd like to wish you all Eid Mubarak. For the CKUT at 90.3 FM and for the Mosaic Show, this is Sarah Hassanin. Thank you for listening.
let's enjoy this happy day. عيد مبارك, come on, let's celebrate. عيد سعيد, let's enjoy this happy day. عيد مبارك, come on, let's celebrate. عيد سعيد, let's enjoy this.
Bye. هويتي وحناني ودنيتي مش بس صاحبتي ده عرف شلة ده عرف شلة باي باي حبيبي باي
listening to Montreal's emerging indie folk gem, Bells Larson. Bells will be playing at the Diving Bells Social Club on September 9th to celebrate the release of his debut album, Good Grief, which explores themes of young love, lost love, and queer love. Join in for a beautiful evening of song and storytelling from Bells and support act Eve Parker Finley. Buy your tickets for September 9th at bluesguysturnblack.com. A CKUT co-presentation.
Youth in Motion presents the Little Burgundy Festival. Come and join the fun with activities for children, prizes to win a diversity game, and delicious and tasty foods for all to discover. The 37th Little Burgundy Festival takes place on Saturday, September 10th at Vinay Park from 12 until 9 p.m. More than 40 artists will take the stage with headliners Jakarta, Maytone, Robin, Melo G, all backed by the Uprising Band. Also, the People's Gospel Choir of Montreal and Algerian singer Amar Hamel. Sensational dance from KB Lee, Tafasut, Un Afro Dance, and B-Boy MTL Crew, and much, much more. That's Saturday, September 10th at Vinay Park in Little Burgundy. Noon to 9 p.m. You done know it's a CKUT Co presentation.